Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 142, and this is our special Super Metroid tribute episode. It's the 15th anniversary of the game's release, and we're going to talk about Super Metroid for the entire podcast, so it'll be a little deviation from our usual format. We're not doing new business or really listener mail or anything like that, but I think this game is, as most of you know, probably is extremely dear to my heart, and I would imagine the rest of these guys and probably a lot of you listening. And if you're not familiar with Super Metroid, I hope you will be by the end of this. I hope this will be mildly informative and at least inspiring. The game has really never been easier to obtain and play. So I think it is one of the seminal games that everyone should play. I mean, really everyone. I mean, and maybe not everyone will like it, but I think it's like a book. You know, it's just one of those books everyone should read. It's like one of those movies that everyone should see. I think this is one of the very, very few games that literally I would recommend to absolutely anyone, because I just think it's one of those experiences. So anyway, I'm Jonathan Metz, your host. Of course, with me as always, Mr. Lindemann.
Hello, hello.
Comma Jonathan. He is the director of NintendoWorldReport.com. We also have James Jones.
Hello.
And Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy.
All right, and I'm going to gradually ramp up the enthusiasm in my voice now that the very somber introduction music has gone away. Didn't want to clash with that. So anyway, Super Metroid, 1994, April 18th, 1994, it launched in North America. And, you know, Greg did a lot of planning, so I'll probably refer to his notes quite a bit, but I think he makes a good point in the notes that, you know, the last time we did an entire episode devoted to one game, it was for The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time, which came out, obviously, several years later, and 4 years later, I guess. Wow, only 4.5 years later.
Yeah.
That's strange to think. It seems like a short period between those two. But, you know, this was a Super Metroid was a fairly late game in the Super Nintendo lifespan, and unlike Ocarina of Time, there is an interesting contrast in that this game was not really heavily hyped before it came out. Now, I was not an especially active gamer in early 1994, so I'm going to let you guys kind of give some more context here, because I'm not really an expert on what gaming was like in 94 when Super Metroid came out.
Well, I mean, it was interesting, because I was thinking about how far, I mean, this is 15 years ago, right? So the internet really hadn't exploded at that time. There was,
nowhere,
you know,
near, no.
Yeah, like nowhere near. I mean, I was online at the time, but it was all like in kind of like
smoke signals,
like news groups. Yeah, I mean, this was around the time when, you know, when like games like Doom were coming out, right? So, you know, that was kind of like that. The PC scene was kind of where gaming was sort of exploding, I guess you could say. And, you know, the Super Nintendo, it had been around a while. Nintendo was kind of a known brand. That whole Nintendo hype, I mean, Nintendo was still huge, but that whole Nintendo hype had kind of, that surrounded the NES and that sort of Mario fever kind of thing. Nintendo was just kind of, you know, they were just kind of a known quantity now. And with Super Metroid, you talk about the hype machine. There was really no video game hype machine like there is now.
It's very
that's
different.
That's
it was very
true.
Different, but it did exist, I think.
It did exist.
You think of a game that came out at the end of the year that we're discussing here in 1994, Donkey Kong Country. That had
Jesus.
A hype machine behind it.
Yes, that had
silly Nintendo Power videos and,
yes.
You know, every magazine going was cramming, you know, just as Super Metroid was coming out, probably, you know, we were seeing all those renders of Donkey Kong underwater with On Guard or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. It was quite the contrast between the two games. And
certainly, but I'm just saying, the hype machine, it wasn't, you know, like now with a game like, you know, Halo 3 or something, you get like a constant daily bombardment. Like, there are so many channels to advertise to people now. It wasn't like that back in 94.
No. And again, I mean, it was different even compared with 98, as we discussed with Ocarina, mm-hmm. because it had begun by then. Now, you know, and Ocarina was sort of one of the first games to really sort of experience that.
Yeah.
Whereas Super Metroid, even for the time, you know, even compared to Donkey Kong Country, was not something that was massively hyped. That certainly just, you know, logistically couldn't be the way games are today.
Well, yeah, and it's different, though, because I would say that most consumers now are considerably more savvy about hype than they were back in 1994.
Yeah.
Because they experience it more. So you'd have to, so I would say that even though there was less hype for games back then, I would say it was probably more impactful than it was than it is now.
So yeah, there's probably an argument for that as a sort of relative naivete about, especially given the kind of the consumer base you were probably talking about back then. Obviously, gaming is quite broader now.
Yeah, I don't remember. I have never heard anyone say anything positive ever about the 360 reveal on MTV, ever. But I know people who spoke highly of those terrible, terrible Nintendo Power videos that we were sent.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was novel to get a videotape in the mail for free that had some content that you cared about. That was a big deal for me back then. But to go back to Super Metroid, honestly, I didn't even know Super Metroid was coming out at the time.
Exactly.
Like, I was so removed from this. I had a Super Nintendo, but after the first couple years, I kind of just got away from gaming. I was playing more PC stuff. I think I was playing, like, TIE Fighter around this time. And I wasn't getting Nintendo Power anymore at that time, I think. Because there was a Nintendo Power with Super Metroid on the cover. But, you know, that would have been the primary hype engine for Nintendo games back then.
Or EGM. If you weren't getting Nintendo Power or EGM... Yeah. You really wouldn't know about it.
You had no news. You had no video game news. Your video game news came from those god-awful consoles Nintendo had in stores that had the little push pad with the game cover box on it.
That's a good point. But so let me make 2 points here. The reasons why Super Metroid maybe didn't have the greatest hype. Number one, if you played it even at a demo kiosk at the game store, that's really not a good way to experience Metroid. I mean, if you play it for 5 minutes, you're not going to get the gist of what it's about, because it is a subtle game. And it does not reveal itself to you very quickly.
No, I would say
What
were the demos? 10 minutes, and then it reset the system. I would say I'd say if you played 10 minutes of Super Metroid, you'd probably think the game is really boring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Primary way that games were promoted back then is in magazines like Nintendo Power, where it was basically a gallery of screenshots and maybe some writing about it. But I think Super Metroid is a game that is really not all that impressive in screenshots.
Yes.
And it's not that it has bad graphics, but like you guys were saying, I mean, if you were seeing screenshots of Donkey Kong Country at the time, you'd look at Super Metroid and think, wow, this looks really dated, you know? Mm-hmm. And part of it's in the animation that it improves. I think the way that the world flows together is very nice. I think there's a lot of surfaces and backgrounds that sort of glow and pulsate. So there are some really impressive graphical effects in the game, but they're not going to come across in screenshots. And the game, honestly, I think this is especially true if you compare it to the other kinds of games that were coming out at the time, it doesn't really flash off the screen. It's not that... it's not flashy.
No.
You know? It doesn't have really bright, eye-catching colors. It's dark and muted and dull. You know, it does have a dull color palette.
It's terrible box art. Terrible box art. It's all cartoony. It does not suit the tone of the game at all.
Are we talking like NES bad?
It's not that bad. It's not that bad. But, I mean, I think what Johnny brings a really important point. You consider the time, the context of the gaming scene, especially the 16-bit scene at the time, was kind of rife with techno supremacism. I mean, if you think it's bad now, it was nothing compared to what it was
but,
like
but
back
it wasn't.
Then.
It was techno supremacism, but it was completely infantile because
exactly. It was like
I thought that was implied.
Well, no, it was worse than it is now because none of it made sense. It was like
It was baseless. It was made up buzzwords. You know,
I have
it
blast
was,
processing.
Right.
What do you
it was all sorts
bullshit.
Of nonsense.
Yeah, because the thing, I mean, also in the mix at the time, you also had, you know, the TurboGrafx-16, which was
ridiculous.
You know, it's like, oh, well, we're the real 16-bit console. Oh, no, we are. Oh, no, we look like a 16-bit console, but we're really not.
Yeah,
but don't worry about it.
No one even knows what 16-bit means.
Yeah, exactly.
But this is the funny thing about, you know, you think, like, at this point, I think Star Fox was about a year ago, you know, so you'd had that whole thing, you know, the FX chip, 3D and all that. Like I said, you had, you know, Donkey Kong Country coming down the pipe. You had, you know, all the stuff that sort of Sega done with like the CD and all, you know, it's like everything kind of had to have a gimmick.
Yeah.
You know, had to have some sort of technical hook that this was the right on the bleeding cutting edge.
Toy Story was 95, wasn't it? Or was it 94?
Yeah, it was 95.
I mean, it was on the horizon, Toy Story was. And that kind of thing was preeminent in people's minds.
Yeah, this was, and also it was just shows you kind of what game developers would do at this point in the 16-bit era, you know, was like, this is how you sell games. You create something that does scream off the page in a screenshot gallery. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
well,
it gets people thinking
that's how
buying...
they had to sell it.
Yep. Exactly. It was like, this is the latest, the greatest, you know, it's you've never seen it before, it's going to blow your hair off.
It was,
you know,
that you had to come up with some kind of crazy ass marketing term for it.
And the thing is, I mean, even like I dug out an old magazine from the old days that had like a European print ad for Super Metroid.
Oh dear God!
And this is how it was marketed: there's 5 different guns, missiles, super missiles, 2 kinds of bombs, and a change of clothes. Well, she is a girl, remember?
Nice.
Samus Aran, the most fearless bounty hunter in the galaxy, is back in Nintendo's most challenging game ever.
I would disagree with that statement. Wholeheartedly.
It's not that nearly that challenging.
It's a shooting, grappling, morphing, brain-numbing 24-meg monster of a game.
That ad is brain-numbing.
I don't know, brain-numbing, is that a good thing? Absolutely. So this is the kind of sort of nonsense that was used at the time. Similar things were like with Donkey Kong Country, like, it's taken 25 years and however many silicon graphics computers to make Donkey Kong look like this much of an idiot or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, this was the kind of silliness that went on at the time.
And they cranked out a sequel a year later, so...
Yeah, Super Metroid didn't really fit into it very well. You know, it's kind of like, I mean, you see that with this ad, it's so awkward. It's like, buy this because it's got loads of weapons in it.
Yeah, and things really haven't changed with the Metroid franchise because Nintendo really still doesn't know how to market it.
Well, it's a little bit easier to market now that it's in.
I honestly think it's easier now. I don't necessarily think they do a great job.
Well,
no,
I think the audience has come up to it rather than the other way around.
I think they met in the middle somewhere.
There's part of that, because it is not an easy game to describe to someone.
Mm-mm. But
I'm not excusing the shit-tacular job of what they did back in 94 that Greg just read, but...
Well, the one that Greg just read, you have to keep in mind also that the video game industry in Europe was managed terribly.
Yeah, very different. Yeah, I mean, that's the European scene. Obviously, I mean, it came out many months later in Europe, for the record, but I was following it in the import scene and everything. So I was aware of it, but then I was, I mean, about as hardcore as a 10-year-old can possibly be.
You know, Super Metroid was not hyped. It was not a runaway success at all when it finally was released. It didn't blow up the sales charts. And it was one of those things that it kind of took a few years before people vocally and publicly gave it props for being a masterpiece. It was just one of those things that it was a cult hit. You know, it was like a small group of people.
I think that's one of the most interesting things is when it came out, it certainly got very good reviews. But it was more of
not
the
that
kind
that
of
mattered,
it was but. More of the kind. I mean, the problem is back in those days, scores were so ridiculously inflated. You know, it was some it was some sort of crushing indictment of something if it got like 80% or
whatever.
Well,
they were bought and paid for. Let's not kid ourselves.
There was a lot of nonsense going on, so it was difficult to filter out, you know, the sort of hyperbole from the legitimate sort of praise. And I think Super Metroid was the recipient of a lot of genuine praise, but in the noise of what was going on at the time. And, you know, there was a lot less sort of jumping up and down about how brilliant it was compared with, you know, some of the other stuff like Donkey Kong Country that came at the end of the year from some people. And but, you know, as time has gone on, Super Metroid has been much more favorably remembered, and now it's a masterpiece.
Well, sure, and part of that is because it's not leveraged on gimmicky graphical techniques.
Yeah,
which
of course date. You know, those things
sure.
date.
Whereas, well,
you know, what
I mean, it's probably it's probably comparable to some of the Squaresoft RPGs of the time, where when they actually came out, like Chrono Trigger. Probably wasn't really appreciated in its own time, but as time went on, people were like, wow, this is an amazing game.
I appreciated it in its own time.
I think Chrono Trigger was more appreciated, to be honest. I mean, I see the point, but I think Chrono Trigger was probably more recognized than Super Metroid.
I agree. Well, I was trying to make a point earlier, I didn't really finish it, but I think that part of the slow start for Super Metroid, the lack of excitement, the lack of recognition, the lack of immediate sales success, is that the game is leveraged very heavily on its predecessors, Metroid and Metroid 2 on Game Boy, and neither of those was a massive hit either. So it's not that you need to play those games before you can play and enjoy Super Metroid, but it is, in some ways, it's not a remake of the first Metroid, but it very heavily references the first Metroid, and then also borrows a lot of mechanics, some of which are fairly difficult to use, like, for instance, the space jump. A lot of other items that come from Metroid 2. So, and it has the save stations, it has the energy recharge stations and things like that. So a lot of the structure of it is a composite of those two on their own fairly obscure games. And so Super Metroid, it makes a lot of sense. It's very easy to get into if you've played one or both of the first two games. But if you haven't, it is so radically different from everything else. Because as much as it references its own predecessors, it references almost nothing else.
And it does not try to help you either. I mean,
it doesn't.
Just tosses
it doesn't
you to the
hold
wolves.
Your hand.
That's something that I think we really need to get into later on. But I mean, with the topic of like its history, you think of the first Metroid, this is a truly groundbreaking game in terms of the sort of the non-linear structure, the way the items sort of interact with your ability to progress through the game.
Sure. Way ahead of its time, way overly ambitious for the technology.
There are some shortcomings with the gameplay. I find it just difficult to play.
I think it's almost unplayable. I really do. And I watched a friend beat it, and I still think it's almost unplayable.
There's a lot of things to commend in that game. But the ambition and the vision in particular, and Super Metroid is very much the culmination of that vision and the sort of the linchpin for the whole series, sort of before and after. But what I think is interesting is that Metroid was so groundbreaking, and it took 8 years for them to make another console version, and yet in the interim there weren't many other games that really pinched from Metroid all that much. You had Castlevania 2, Simon's Quest, which was a little bit that way. And, of course, much later, you had Symphony of the Night. That was all after Super Metroid.
Well,
but
I don't know the timing, but I kind of want to say that Mylan's Secret Castle might have drawn from the original Metroid a little bit.
That's very easy.
There were some other games. Yeah. There were things like, what was it, Legacy of the Wizard or Dynasty of the Wizard. There was a Falcom game that involved, like, a family of... You know, a family and you alternated characters. It was very much exploration based, and
maybe a Blaster Master to a certain degree.
Yeah. I think
very
that's fair.
Subterranean.
I mean, I think a lot of games shot for that goal and maybe didn't. They weren't as ambitious as Metroid, and maybe for the better, because, like I said, I think Metroid was really too much for the technology at the time. But I don't think it was without influence on other games. But what strikes me is that playing Super Metroid, it's not really reminiscent of any other games except the first two Metroid games. Mm-hmm. So I think for a non-fan, it's somewhat difficult to get into in that it's not familiar at all, you know? And then for other people, it's incredibly familiar.
Well, but Metroid 2, of course, is that it sort of introduced a lot of things that have kind of really made, you know, become strongly associated with the whole series, like Samus's look with the big shoulders on the Variazoo and the ship she has and all those different abilities that they introduced and all that. But it was so different from the first Metroid. It was less ambitious in the sense that it kind of pared the structure down to this kill Metroids to advance kind of thing.
Well, I think they were very smart with Metroid 2 in that they actually adapted the structure of the game that it would work with the technology, which they didn't
because you're
really
talking
do
about
the first
an
one.
8-bit, you know, you're just talking about an 8-bit game, and we're talking about going back, you know, sort of, you know, to the Game Boy. You've got the lower resolution, you've got all these things. It's, you know, I mean, to try and, you know, further what they did in the original Metroid, the way they did in Super Metroid, would have been extremely difficult. But then that was is what makes Super Metroid so unique, because this is where they really could do it. They, you know, they could actually do kind of probably what they wanted to do in the first place. And I really think that that is a lot of the reason why the game was made, was out of this strong desire to see that happen, to see that sort of realized. Because if you look at what happened with the development teams, R&D 1, which was, headed by Gunpei Yokoi, and they primarily kind of made hardware a lot in the early days, like the arcade machines and all this sort of stuff. They made a bunch of NES games, a lot of the sports games, and then they made Metroid, which was definitely like the most ambitious thing that they'd made.
Did they make Kid Icarus as well?
They did.
They obviously share technology, but
There's a lot of overlap between those two games.
Which, to counter the previous ad discussion, is the hardest game Nintendo has ever made.
I can agree with that. Yes,
recommended for everyone. Also recommended for everyone.
But you know, so they made these two games. But then what happened after that was quite a lot of organizational sort of craziness. They split into Intelligent Systems was created after Metroid, which was sort of split off and continues to exist today. Has developed the Fire Emblem series, the Paper Mario games. I mean, they've done a lot of stuff since then, but they kind of split off. And then, of course, what with Gunpei Yokoi and a lot of R&D1 became very heavily involved in the Game Boy. They created the hardware, and they were responsible for creating a lot of the flagship titles like Super Mario Land and its sequels. And Metroid 2, funnily enough, was by Intelligent Systems, not R&D1.
Well, it's the shuffling of teams at Nintendo is an ever going process.
Yeah, there was a lot of, you know, sort of, it was a little bit incestuous, I suppose. As people go back and forth, they were still sort of strongly connected, but you know, with Metroid 2 you didn't have Yoshio Sakamoto, who was the director of the original Metroid, working on that,
which honestly might have turned out for the better that they brought some new blood into it.
Absolutely. And so but then what happened with Super Metroid is that even after, and you know, in the years leading into the Super NES, yeah, the R&D1 got kind of broken down more and more, and really had very limited impact on the consoles. It was so focused on Game Boy that at this point they were pretty much making like Super Scope games and like Mario Paint, you know, hardware driven stuff. You know, Super Metroid is miles away from what they were doing. You know, so I think what it says is that it was a labor of love. You know, they brought back Sakamoto,
like Mega Man 2.
You know, they brought back in all these people to sort of that worked on the original, whether they had sort of gone off to Intelligent Systems or these other part, or they'd been working on the Game Boy, and they kind of united it all to make this, you know, to make this game that they clearly wanted to make more than anything. And it really shows, I think, in the game itself, that this was a labor of love, that they wanted it, you know, so much.
Maybe they pushed for it. And they said, let's get the team
together.
I think, supposedly,
I mean, obviously these sorts of things are kind of cloudy, but, you know, the stories that you hear is that, you know, it was an uphill battle to get this made, in terms of the game kept getting bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Nintendo, you know, probably looking at the sales of the previous games of the series, especially in Japan, where it was never quite as successful, and that certainly bore out with Super Metroid in the end. You know, probably say, you know, do we want to be, you know, devoting this attention to this sort of thing? And, you know, I think it was an uphill battle, and it went on and was apparently beset with difficulties, but, you know, in the end, they
got it done. You
wonder
if people were working on it in their overtime and, you know, just after hours kind of stuff, because you do hear about that sometimes, you know.
Yeah, I don't know how much you hear about that over at Nintendo, though, where they'll basically demand every hour they can get out of you working on the project you're on anyway. Mm-hmm. Because schedules matter at Nintendo, especially in the mid to late 90s. Release schedules are all important. I think it's part of the reason that a lot of the crew was brought back together is Nintendo does like to also repeat casts on game development. if you're involved in a major title for them, there's a very real possibility you will never escape that franchise. I think you can see that a lot with
Onuma.
Well, yeah.
He's been doing Zelda.
The
since...
poor bastard got caught in all the Zelda, but I was actually referring to Creatures and Creatures Inc.
Pokemon. Yeah. But that's the thing, see, I mean, you think about that, see, but I mean, Zelda and certainly Pokemon, I mean, they're these commercial juggernauts, you know, I mean, Nintendo's very eager to put the handcuffs on.
Right.
Whereas I think in this case, that was not why this game existed.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Metroid as a series is way more artsy than just about anything Nintendo makes. I mean, yeah, it's pretty out there, it's very experimental, it's very moody. They, you know, they tell stories in a way that's not done with any of their other series, and they ask things of the player that really are never asked in any other Nintendo game. I mean, it really is a black sheep of the entire company.
Mm-hmm.
There's just, they don't make anything like Super Metroid.
I think, though, that even though those games were commercial successes, so obviously they had much more interest in keeping the crew together, I think it's just something Nintendo likes to do because they are a very conservative company.
Well, it makes the product predictable.
Yes, they
they like to play it safe with stuff that has sold.
Well, yes, but
that's why it's playing it safe. Whereas, you know, with this, especially because at the time it was the biggest, as the wonderful European commercial referenced, it was like one of the biggest cartridge games there had been at 24 meg or whatever it was. So that meant that it was expensive to produce. You know, that obviously meant it was the scope of the game meant it was expensive to develop. You know, so, I mean, you know, in terms of the risk-reward, you know, I don't think this was something that was, you know, the initiative was Nintendo's cold calculating revenue approach. You know, this was because, you know, these people probably over at RD1, you know, specifically wanted it, and they probably had enough autonomy back then to swing it.
When you look at the scarcity of the series, I think there are two ways you could look at it. You could say, well, they don't make the Metroid games very often because they're not major sellers. And this is pre-Metroid Prime, obviously, when they cranked out three games in 7 years.
Well, even then, those games weren't major sellers. They sell reasonably.
They were good enough to keep making them.
Right,
and honestly, Metroid, look, I mean, people say Metroid's not popular in Japan, but the NES one sold 1 million copies in Japan. Now, everything sold 1 million copies in Japan.
Yes.
But that doesn't take away from the fact that there were at least 1 million people in Japan who played Metroid on NES. So it's not like it's way obscure or anything.
Which, of course, is why it's kind of shocking that it was pretty much Super Metroid was a total bomb in Japan. I mean, I think it was modestly successful in Europe. Exactly. This is the problem when you don't kind of keep this exactly.
It wasn't even Street Fighter.
As far as Metroid 2 goes, you know, that was 5 years after. Now, when you consider what they did with Mario, what they did with Zelda, you know, they had sequels on the NES, they had then went portable as well.
Back to my question that, you know, Metroid, until the Prime series, which I'll set aside for now, has never been incentivized. It's never been sequelized, serialized. Year after year, every 1 or 2 years, you have a new one. And so many Nintendo franchises are like that. Now, you could say maybe it's because the individual games don't sell that well, and so they want to space them out more. Or maybe it's just that the people who are creating them don't feel like it can be commoditized in that way. You know, maybe because they are such artistic endeavors, there's so much creative juice that goes into them, it's not something that you can just keep up on a regular schedule.
No, I think that's true. No. I believe there were comments, supposedly Sakamoto said about Super Metroid, why it took so long was that, you know, they were waiting for the right time to be able to do it. You know, they wanted to do it right. You know, this was not something that they were going to, you know, sort of crank out for the Super Famicom's launch or something, you know. This was about kind of the culmination of a vision. So, I mean, that very much fits into what you're saying.
I mean, and that's the thing about Metroid. It's basically one level. It's one gigantic, very intimately connected level. And that kind of thing is extremely difficult to create. And if you look at the differences between, you know, Metroid, Metroid 2, Super Metroid, Metroid Fusion, even Zero Mission, although some of these games share certain areas, it's more of a, you know, a tip of the hat because they're even very significantly redesigned. Whereas if you look at the Metroidvania series like Symphony of the Night and on, there were entire sections of the castle that they would pretty much just copy and paste from one game to another.
Yeah, well, they certainly didn't were not as invested in creating sort of organic world at all in those.
Exactly. So in that series, it was more about the overlay, the other trappings. You know, how what kind of new character do we put in? What abilities does this character have? But the level design itself is really very heavily remixed from game to game, and that's not the case in Metroid. So I think it's just the kind of game that is not easy to just crank out sequels to very quickly. So, all right. Well, we've had a lot of we've had kind of a macrocosm look at the history of the game and what was surrounding it at the time. So I think it's time to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about our personal experiences, thoughts on the game itself, which we haven't talked that much about yet, in terms of how it plays, what it's about, and then we'll maybe look at some of the aftermath, or not aftermath, is kind of, I guess, has a negative connotation, but the legacy of Super Metroid. So we're going to take a break. When we get back, we'll talk about those things. Everyone, we're back for segment two of the Super Metroid retrospective, I guess I should say. And since we already kind of covered all the historical context and everything, I want us to get really personal now and talk about what our experiences were playing Super Metroid for the first time, maybe over the years, maybe like what was your most recent experience, and has your what I'm most interested in is not so much the anecdotes, but like how has your feeling about the game changed over time? So let's start with James.
You know, I played the game twice. And that's, for me, that was...
Not enough.
No, for me, that was enough.
And no, that's not enough.
It's not a negative comment on the game, a commentary on the game. It's just, for me, that was enough to feel like I had completed the game. And when I went back to it the second time, I don't know, 5 years later. So the first time was probably 2000. When I came back and played it through again in about 2005. You know, I didn't... It felt like I was now comfortable with the game enough that I didn't need this have this desire to go through and play it continually. Whereas before, I kind of had this... In my mind, it had never really been formalized and formed as saying, this is what this game is. So, you know, I had beaten it, but it was still kind of a nebulous construct as to how to describe that game.
That doesn't surprise me.
And as I went back to play...
I'm not disparaging you, I just think it's that kind of game. Where you could play through the entire thing without fully understanding what you just did.
And when I went back and played it, you know, it cemented what the game is to me.
Which is?
Well, to me, it's a game that leverages exploration sometimes at the expense of the player, but does so with enough ambiance to sort of cover that up and make the game an enjoyable experience anyway.
So, John, how many times do you think you've played Super Metroid?
I was thinking about that. I know that it's one of the few games... I tend to not play through games more than once. But I think that I've played it all the way through at least twice, probably three times. the way I kind of think about it in my head is it's one of the few games that sort of you kind of bring something to it. It doesn't help you at all. It just kind of is what it is.
Yeah, now that's really interesting, I think, is how organically it kind of does everything.
There's no hint system.
No.
There's no hints. There's no text in the game of any consequence after the intro.
Nope.
And I mean, when you've got things where you might have quite advanced techniques like the super jump or the shine sparking or the wall jumping and all that, and it teaches you with those little animals showing you what to do.
Yes.
It doesn't say press B to do this or press, you know, it just shows you in this sort of totally organic way. You know, and I just think that's something that would never happen in a game now.
Not now.
I mean, certainly not in the Metroid Prime series.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's funny because now that would be actually considered bad design, because so many games nowadays try to cater to such a broad spectrum of players. You know, bring in the people that have never played a game before, but then also cater to the people that are really, really hardcore. Super Metroid really didn't do either one of those. It just said, okay, go ahead, explore.
But a lot of games did that then. I mean, did the original Mario game tell you how to play it? Hell no.
It still had things like the little voice boxes.
The original Mario is linear.
It's much more easy to grasp, and especially when you're talking about, like, you know, stuff like wall jumping or, like, you know,
right,
like
but
Charlie's Park, that stuff is way more complicated.
I gather that the concept of really guiding the player through it in the sort of tutorial sense might not have developed as fully at that point as we expect it to now.
Not in the formal sense.
Completely, no. Yeah, I agree.
I mean, I think my point of view on this is that it was a conscious decision within the game's design to keep it as sort of uncluttered as possible.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at sort of things like with the intro sequence and things like that, where and then when you the arrival on ZB's as well, it's very kind of almost like a cutscene, but it isn't actually a cutscene in terms of you don't know that you're playing a cutscene, because really, you know, you get to the space station, you walk through, everyone's dead, you know, and then you face Ridley. And, you know, you can't really win that fight. He just goes.
You can't really lose it, can you?
You can't really lose it either. He just flies off with it. But you don't know that, because it's not. If it's a cutscene, you sort of switch back into, okay, I'm watching this mode. Whereas the way Super Metroid does it, you don't know, really, is this something that I do have a sort of control over or I don't. But, you know, you kind of have to assume that you do. And it's more involving that way.
It's a very effective way. I mean, in terms, I think it works really well within the context of the game, because, you know, the look at the plot. She arrives on this planet, really has no idea what's going on, and has to figure out the world around her, has to figure out how to interact with stuff. Just really, like we were talking about how you're just kind of thrust into the game. Well, that's exactly it. There's kind of this like meta exploration of how to do everything in the game, above even the fact that you're exploring the environment.
Well, I think one of the things that stands out to me about Metro, especially compared to its successors, but which we'll probably discuss a bit later on, but is that it sort of has this storytelling style with no plot or dialogue really to speak of at all.
Well, there is a plot, but you're playing through it. It's not being presented to you, really.
Yeah, but the storytelling aspect is just the pure sort of the more essential quality of you arrive on ZB's, for instance, and at first, you know, the music is totally ambient, and you're sort of searching the ruins of what was destroyed at the end of the first Metroid, and it seems like there's nothing there. And then all of a sudden, bang, you know, the enemies emerge and sort of come at, you know, it's sort of really is storytelling through gameplay, rather than storytelling through cutscenes and dialogue and all that, which is, you know, like I said, obviously storytelling through gameplay doesn't really lend itself to like plot heavy stuff or dialogue heavy stuff, of course. But that's what makes it interesting to me, is that it's something that even now a lot of games don't necessarily do, and that Metroid itself has gotten away from.
So, John, when was the last time that you played Super Metroid?
Well, I did play it. I didn't play it all the way through when it came out on the Virtual Console is when I played it. I played quite a number of hours of it. I think I got to a point that I just couldn't figure out, and I stopped. But I believe I played it when it first came out. It was interesting, you know, going back to the kind of the way the video game, you know, industry was back then. I mean, I don't think I actually knew that Super Metroid was even coming out until I walked into, like, Blockbuster and saw that it was actually on the shelf, and I was like, oh my god, Super Metroid's out.
So obviously James played it way after, 6 years later. When you weren't aware of its existence until it came out, basically, but did you buy it straight away, or did you wait, or did you see reviews?
I think, if I remember correctly, I probably bought it in sometime in 95.
Right.
Was it? I mean, it's 24. Is it megabits?
Megabits.
Yeah, I hate that. It was probably a fairly expensive cartridge, wasn't it?
No, because it was Nintendo, so they could easily subsidize that stuff.
And it was not the largest ever. I think the largest ever was like 40 megabits, and that was, I want to say, Fire Emblem 2, which was a Japan-only game.
I wouldn't be surprised at all if it was Fire Emblem 2.
It had like an intro FMV and a fully, like, you know, like a Redbook audio theme song.
Yeah, it's
and
massive.
All kinds of craziness. Yeah.
Mine was Intelligent Systems as well, so I guess these people who did the programming on Super Metroid, so they did a lot of big cartridges back then.
Yeah,
they were always the same price. All of the Nintendo games across the board, no matter what they were always the same price.
Okay.
So it wasn't like a Squaresoft
game. Again,
what
that would have meant is that the margin on Super Metroid probably wouldn't have been that good for Nintendo.
That's right.
My point on that one that I was going to get to, then I got completely sidetracked by Nintendo's pricing stratagems. Was when you played it, I guess it had kind of already passed as a selling item and it kind of been relegated to history at that point.
Well, it's a thing. I mean, when I played it through, I was really outside of the hype. I mean, I liked it. You know, I don't think I ever really played. I can't remember honestly why I actually picked it up. I think probably at the time I was really into platformers. And I just thought that it really looked cool because I didn't play any of the other Metroids because I did play it on the NES like way, way back. The thing is, it was such a huge gap. You know, I think I did play it through on the NES. I never played any of the Game Boy stuff, but it was probably one of those games that I just kind of took a flyer on it. Like, I was just like, yeah, it was probably pretty cool for the NES and here's the sequel, so let's give it a shot. I do remember distinctly that I was absolutely blown away by how good it was. Like, when I was finished it, I was like, oh my god, that was unbelievable. Like, it immediately shot up to, like, you know, one of the best games I had ever played. And I was actually quite surprised because the original Metroid was good, but not even close to what Super Metroid was.
Now, John, I think the most interesting thing that you've said is that when you went back to play it on Virtual Console in 2007, probably, or 2008, that you got stuck and quit. And what's interesting to me is that this is a game that you've already beaten at least two or three times.
Uh-huh.
And it reminded me of something that has occurred to me in replaying this game over the years, is that I will remember the most arcane details of where a secret missile is.
Yeah.
But in terms of like the flow of the game, where to go next, I still get stuck too. In fact, I was playing it today, and I'm about halfway through the game. I could not for the life of me remember where the fucking grappling hook is.
Yeah.
And this is a game I've played five or six times all the way through.
That's how the image I had of the game got concreted in my mind. Sometimes it does this exploration thing to a fault.
I think that's part of why it's so replayable, is that the exploration elements are so complex and deep that it's not a game that is easily memorized, you know?
Yeah.
It's not like a point-and-click adventure game where you just remember the solutions to the puzzles, and that it's almost not even worth playing through it again. It's just rote memorization, whereas
it does demand your focus. It really demands that your
The levels
focus
are
on
so
it.
Intricate in Super Metroid that it's extremely difficult to truly memorize them. And so there is always a sense of discovery as you go back to it, even if you're very familiar. You're like, oh, you know, I forgot that these rooms connected in that way. Mm-hmm. Because there's so many rooms that connect in so many ways. It's just you're not likely to completely memorize the game, and that's part of what makes it enjoyable for me to go back through.
And there's always stuff like false walls where you're like, you know, and you can change it into the ball form and, you know, find little false walls. There's all this kind of stuff that's just all over the place. I remember, much like Symphony of the Night, I went through, and I mean with the when you get the X-ray beam where you can see through walls. Mm-hmm. I remember when I first played through it, I mean, actually, probably both times, I went everywhere. I mean, I checked every single wall in that damn game.
So obsessive compulsive, man.
Completely. I did everything.
Yeah. You know, there's plenty of people that have probably done it, though, you know, with the, replays that go into this. And, you know, I mean, I think the discovery part is obviously totally crucial to this game, but I really think the way that it was so hands-off, they didn't, like, make so many things explicit, and obviously you had the map, which was a huge, huge help compared to previous Metroid games. You know,
it makes the game so much more enjoyable.
Yeah, and of course it allows it to be as intricate as it is, because it is somewhat manageable when you've got a map and you can see where you have been, where you haven't been, how things may interconnect. You can kind of guess looking at the map and stuff like that.
Fill in the blank spaces.
Yeah, but, you know, the fact that there was a feeling that there was so much that maybe could be discovered because there were so many things in it that it wouldn't just make clear. You know, like, for instance, Johnny, you brought this up when we were preparing for the show, like, these secret techniques that you could use, like, with the beams, like, that would revealed in the attract sequence on the title screen. But otherwise, you know, it's not in the manual, it's not, you know, anywhere.
And notice, even in the attract mode, it doesn't tell you how to do it. So you just have to plain explore. You know, mm-hmm. you just have to experiment and try things. And the way you do those, some people may still not know about them, but the way you do them is you equip the charge beam and one other beam. So you have to unstack a couple of beams in order to do this. And you select the power bombs on your bar up at the top. And then you hold down the charge beam. And I think either as you hold it or when you let it go, depending on the beam, it has a special kind of aura effect that you will never get otherwise. So it's a very specific set of conditions under which you can use this move. They're not very practical. They use up some of your power bombs. Yeah. But the really cool thing about them is they were essentially the inspiration for the super moves in Metroid Prime. So, you know, the moves that you could, you could charge up the plasma beam, for instance, in Metroid Prime and do this lava jet thing where you just spray it wherever and it uses up a bunch of your missiles. That is inspired from these charge beam moves back in Super Metroid that are very obscure.
The crystal flash, I think, is how it's referred to, where you could actually recover some of your health using some weird power bomb trick where
my mind when I saw it in this, Nintendo Power.
I remember seeing that in the attract sequence, and the fact that Super Metroid, like, you know, I would get stuck and I would actually want to see the attract sequence to, like, see more of the game, and the music's great and all that. You know, it was the only game I would ever sit through that for. And I think it's on the second reel that you get to the crazy stuff. And when that happened, when you, like, she's kind of in this energy field and there's the silhouette of her without the suit, it's kind of like, what the hell is that? What is going on there? You know,
and that's another thing they took over to Metroid Prime is the attract sequences that kind of show you some of the secrets of the game.
Yeah. The fact that you had this stuff there, but it was not signposted, it was not sort of necessarily even, like, particularly integrated together. It kind of encouraged sort of experimentation and exploration in a way that few games can.
And I would even say the crystal flash is completely useless. I mean, the conditions are so impractical. It's just something that you would go out and specifically try to use because it looks cool. Yeah. But it's not. Not only is it completely optional, it's not even helpful to know how to do it.
But it's just like, cool. Those things kind of added to the kind of mystery in the game, and like the feeling that there was just there could be anything in there, maybe. that for you to find, and so, you know, people, you know, scanning every wall, you know, blowing stuff up, trying improbable bomb jumps, you know, and this is how people end up doing these sequence breaking tricks and for like speed runs and all sorts of crazy stuff.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, it was one of the very first sandbox games, just because there was all kinds of stuff you could do. It didn't sit there and say, okay, well, here are the controls, and these are the five things that you can do with them. It's like, yeah, you can kind of do stuff. You know, you can do these kind of things, and you know what? You can also play around with them a little bit, and maybe you'll find something.
Well, if you became
mix and match abilities.
If you kind of became proficient at wall jumping before it kind of showed you that you could do it, which is difficult because it's just difficult to do in that game.
I got the wave beam way early.
Because you could break the structure of the game pretty soundly using that.
But that was okay, though. It let you do that.
The great thing is the game doesn't actually break when you do that.
Yeah.
It's so robustly designed that, yeah, you can break the sequence of the order that it expects you to do things, but you're not breaking the game.
No, you're not going off.
You can still play it. It's just you're not even really cheating. You're just taking advantage of your knowledge of the game.
Yeah, a different way. And that's what's so great. It's like John said, it's got this sandbox where you can sort of apply yourself to it. And people have been for over the last 15 years in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, and that really started in the NES version where you knew that once you got the bombs and you knew that you could kind of bomb yourself up, and you would see these things way up on a ledge, and you were like, you know what? If I sat here and timed it just right, I could get up to that thing by bomb jumping. And you knew it, and that started everything. And that's just so... Just the fact that you kind of know, like, you almost have that control. Like, it's almost like you're...
Freedom, yeah.
It's so ballsy for Nintendo to create a game with those possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so risky, and you have to anticipate those things, and they do. You know, I mean, when you design a game that is so open in structure like this, you have to be prepared for the player to do things that you don't necessarily want them to do, but it is possible for them to do that. And it's just, you know, you compare it to things like the Zelda series where you can't really do that in most of the Zelda games. You can't really go to dungeons out of order, maybe in the first one. But after that, they really rein that in, and there's a certain experience that we want you to have. We want you to do these things in this order. And it's very easy to break a game if you give the player the opportunity to do things as they choose and to have that much freedom. And to have these level designs that are very open. There are multiple ways to get to certain areas, and that is extremely difficult to design. And I mean, it's just a major factor in the game's brilliance, I think, that they allowed that to happen, because it's so much easier to say, you know what, we're going to take out bomb jumping because it can be abused. Because you can go to places before you're supposed to. Mm-hmm. And instead, they said, you know what, we're going to leave this in, and if you're skillful enough to actually use it, knock yourself
good
silly.
For you. Yeah, that's right.
That is incredible, and you do not see that in very many games, for very good reason. So, Greg, what's your story?
The reviews at the time were good. They weren't like, like I said, this climate of noise and silliness, it was kind of difficult to tell. It was great, and I had no real experience with the Metroid series at all, so I was kind of not sure whether this was the sort of game that I would like. And then sometime after it came out in Europe, several months later, there was sort of more coverage of it. And like a friend of mine had a copy and stuff like this. So eventually I did get to play. It's probably in sort of early-ish 95 by the time I get around to playing it. And much like John, I was kind of shocked at how great I found it to be. Because unlike, you know, Ocarina of Time, which we talked about, you know, a few months ago, you didn't have this weight of expectation, you know, that it was going to be one of the best things you've ever played coming into it. You know, far from it. And there's so much of it that you didn't really know what to expect, you know. And
had you played the previous Metroid games?
I had probably played a trivial amount of the original Metroid, like, you know, never owned a copy or anything, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, really nothing much to go on whatsoever. You know, you kind of like the idea. I like the idea of the exploration kind of aspect because I very much like Link to the Past. But I mean, it is. But you know, it seemed so different. I was kind of not sure whether I would like it. But I mean, God, I mean, it really made a huge impression on me. And this is a game I've played through several times since. I think I played through it three times when it came out on the Virtual Console. Because I mean, it's you can get through it really quickly even without some of the more advanced sequence breaking. Like, I mean, if you know what you're doing and all that, you know, like you said, it's quite difficult to know what you're doing sometimes, but if you've literally just played it and you've got to play it again, you can do it in like 90 minutes quite easily. And,
yeah,
you know,
well,
it's
that's
just
impressive.
It's without like the some people could do it in like under an hour. I mean, this really advanced stuff going on into that, but you know, it's so eminently replayable for me because the music, for a start, is incredible, and the whole sound design, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, the music's wonderful. It's obviously it's very atmospheric. That's its primary sort of asset, but it also recalls a lot of the themes from the original Metroid, which didn't mean anything to me at the time, but I can appreciate now how it kind of, you know, sort of wove back and forth. I mean, there is a lot of stuff, obviously, like the appearance fanfares and the item gets and all that are so classic, but also stuff like the Turian theme at the end is a sort of very ambient version of what was in the original Metroid. There's so much there that must, if you were somebody who kind of braved some of the difficulties of the original Metroid and loved it, I can only imagine that must have been really joyous.
Well, at the time, it was like, you know, it was kind of, it almost felt like you were in kind of like your exclusive little club, like, you know what I mean? Like, because you knew that most people would not appreciate the game for what it was. So, you know, to go in and, you know, play through the whole thing, it was pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, aside from the music, the sound effects are incredible, mm-hmm. as well. But I think they are because they sound nothing like any other sound effects on the Super NES.
No.
Yeah, so many sound effects in games, they sound a bit like something else. You know, you play Konami games from that era, a lot of the sound effects sound kind of similar between games and things like that, but these just completely different. I mean, you know, like the missiles, the bombs, the beams, everything was totally distinctive and, you know, very impactful, had a real weight to them. You know, it was, I mean, all of the attention to detail stuff is what really sort of hits you with it.
Yep.
You know, and obviously the atmosphere is something very different from what most games were sort of peddling at the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'm going to get up on my soapbox a little now.
Here we go.
And I think it's really interesting that John and Greg both noted that they were immediately bowled over by this game when they played it, because that wasn't really the case with me. And I think, you know, a lot of our listeners probably know that I'm pretty obsessed with the Metroid franchise, both the 2D and the Prime series. But what it might shock some people to know is that I didn't own a Metroid game until 1999, probably early 99, and that was Metroid 2.
Yeah.
But my history with it goes back a lot farther than that. So when I was a kid in kindergarten, this would have been about 1987, 88, my best friend Wesley Jones had an NES, and he was the first person I knew who had an NES. I would go to his house almost every single day after school, and we would play Nintendo. And a lot of times it was me playing and him watching, or him playing and me watching. So we played a lot of single-player games. We didn't really play that much two-player. And that, it was fine, you know, like, what, it was exciting for me to watch him play a game and get somewhere new. That was enough. And Metroid is the game that I most associate with that memory, because it is very, you know, it was a password-driven game. It's, you make some progress, and then you take a password down, you come back the next day and play it. So what would happen is I would go over and watch him do something brand new. He would get the wave beam, and you know, it was like, oh my God, we just got to a completely new plateau in this game, and now we can go to so many different places. Like, this is the coolest. So my main memory of this time is watching him beat Mother Brain. He had a password. It wasn't the Justin Bailey password. Like, this was a hard-earned password. He actually made it all the way through the game. I'm sure he had a strategy guide, Nintendo Powers, to help him through. But he played through the entire game and got to Turian and had a password for that. So I watched him go through Turian, which is horrifying for a 5-6-year-old kid. Turian is, on the NES especially, is creepy. It's like the first time in a video game I can remember being kind of unsettled by what was going on. Because the music is very oppressive. You've got these little ringlet things coming out of the walls everywhere. It's like, how do you not get hurt? And there, and one thing you realize when you start fighting Mother Brain is you don't not get hurt. Like, there's so much shit flying everywhere that it's almost impossible to avoid getting hit. You just have to kind of minimize it and keep your eye on the prize. But watching him play through Turian, kill the actual Metroids, which was amazing, you know, to finally see these things, and those guys are really terrifying. Mm-hmm. And I still think they play up on that a lot in Metroid Prime, is the fact that the Metroids are just scary. You know, they come at you and they start sucking on your brain. It's like, whoa, this is not what I expected from what I saw before in this game. And then he gets to the Mother Brain, and that whole room where you're blasting through these crazy things in the walls, the rings are flying at you, there's guns in the walls, which you've never seen in the game before. When you get to Mother Brain, you have to break the glass case before you can even start hurting it. This is a climax in a video game of the kind that I'd never seen before and have rarely seen since, in that all the elements of the game come together, and then they throw a lot of new things at you in the final moments of the game that you really just kind of have to deal with. You have to learn very quickly what to do, and it's extremely difficult. If you don't have over 200 missiles, you're probably not going to kill Mother Brain.
True.
and that requires some pretty deep exploration of the game leading up to that, you know. So it is incredibly impressive to watch anyone beat Metroid, because it is a very difficult game, and especially the ending is the most difficult part of it, I think. So I watched him actually beat Mother Brain. And then, that's not even the end of the game. Then you have to escape through this shaft. It's very dramatic and intense. It's difficult to get out before the time limit is up. And this made a very strong impression on me as a kid. And I never owned Metroid for NES. In fact, I never have. I still, to this day, don't own a copy of it. But I felt like I experienced it in a very profound way just by watching my friend. And, you know, every now and then I would play through the early part of the game. I definitely played it. And more than a trivial amount, but it was watching him progress through it. A few years later, as I've mentioned on the show before, I never owned a Game Boy, the original Game Boy. By the way, happy 20th birthday, Game Boy.
Woot.
But I did have a lot of exposure to Game Boy, in that I had a couple friends who had them. So I played a fair bit of Metroid 2, and you know, this was a few years later, but I really liked Metroid 2 as well. You know, and I thought it was interesting that it was so different from the first one, but I liked it. I had read about it in Nintendo Power, which I was very devoted to at the time. So I remember getting to the Queen Metroid, and I probably never beat her, because again, very, very difficult final boss to that game. But I did get to her, and so I saw pretty much the entire game, and I was familiar with it. Then, if you fast forward to 1994, when Super Metroid came out, as I said earlier in the show, I was oblivious to it. You know, I wasn't really up on Nintendo culture or what was happening at the time, so I wasn't all that aware that a new Metroid game was coming out, and I didn't really understand the significance of that either, being as young as I was. I had another very good friend who was also a big gamer, and he got Super Metroid pretty much right when it first came out. And so when I was hanging out at his house, I'd see them play it. I'd be very curious about it. I'd watch him play it for a while. I'd get to try it myself. And within a few months, he finished it and let me borrow it. And so I got to take it home and play through it outright, you know. And this is the first time that I really played a Metroid game at home by myself, probably the way it should be played, honestly, being a very solitary, foreboding, moody game. This was the first time that I really played a Metroid game by myself. And I played through the entire game and beat it. And what's interesting to me, listening to your guys' stories, is that I don't remember being blown away by it. I don't remember thinking, wow, this is one of the best games I've ever played, or, you know, this game does so many cool things that I've never seen done before in anything. And I do think I loved it. I mean, I think I really, truly loved it. But I think it took over me in a very quiet way, you know? I didn't realize how much I loved it at the time. I just, you know, it just swept over me like a wave of water, and I absorbed it, and I appreciated it, but I didn't really put it in those terms of, my God, this is incredible. It didn't occur to me how much I enjoyed it.
I think after I beat Super Metroid for the first time, I think I may have actually sat there on my couch, dropped my joystick, and said, that is the best video game I've ever played. Out loud
wow.
to myself.
Yeah, I had... That's awesome.
Yeah.
But I don't have any memory like that. And it could be that... I don't remember specifically, but it's possible that I watched my friend beat it, you know, so it's possible that a lot of these key scenes were spoiled for me. Mm-hmm. So for me, playing it at home, it was more about the progression. It was more, oh, now I see how this part of the game connects to this part of the game, because I saw these separately at my friend's house, and there were, you know, there was a break in between where he did a lot of things that I didn't watch. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was more about how all this connects together. And I think also, because I had a fair bit of experience with the first two games, even though I never owned them and never played them myself all the way through alone at home, because I was very familiar with them, Super Metroid is, in many ways, a very natural progression. And so a lot of the elements of it and of the structure were expected for me. You know, it was like, oh, well, yeah, I mean, I know I have to go back and explore in this area because I just got that new beam and, you know, it opens up some new places over here. Like, I understood where the game was coming from, and I expected it to do a lot of the things that it did. So I think that was the other thing, is that it wasn't a shock to my system the way it probably was for some people.
Yeah, that's definitely for me. It was, absolutely. I mean, I guess that one thing, you know, that I thought really stood out at the time was just the thrill of seeing new places when you'd been stuck for a while. It was a great reward to actually...
It is a thrill.
Yeah,
you know,
because
still,
there would be times when you didn't know what you were doing and you would cover the same ground and see the same places and hear the
same
music,
same enemies
banging your head against the wall, like, what the hell do I do? And when you got to a new place, it was, you know, new music, totally different, you know, visuals, and all that. It was like, oh, wow. I mean, I think there was one part that really I always remember for that, which was, it's towards the end of the game where you come back to Norfair and enter the lower part, and it's got that music.
For Ridley?
It's got the music that's reprised in Metroid Prime in the caverns, that's sort of like a march. And, you know, that was like, there was a real feeling of sort of like, yeah, this, I'm getting towards the end of the game now, you know, this is sort of gathering pace and the enemies get quite a lot harder and, you know, it's fantastic. And that sensation of being rewarded for all your sort of labours to get to that point is not something that many games, you know, could give you, I don't think, you know, that sort of real joyful kind of discovery. It's just because, yeah, the music and the ambience was so great, you just wanted to see more.
Yeah,
that was the real driving factor for me. It was not so much, oh, I want to beat the game, I want to finish the game, I want to see everything.
Well, I found it to be kind of the perfect blend of an action game and almost, you know, an RPG to a certain degree, because, like, in an RPG, one of the things I always enjoy is near the end of a game when you can go back through the very first areas and you can say, oh, yeah, I remember when my character was level 10 and he's now level 80, and I remember when I did this and I couldn't beat that guy and now I can go in and beat that guy. And Super Metroid is exactly like that, because you go through, like, a lot of times as a matter of course, to get where you want to go, you have to go through all of these old areas, and you're kind of thinking back to, oh, I remember when I didn't have this beam and I couldn't go there, and look what I can do now.
Yeah,
and it's
exactly.
Very rewarding.
It's, as we've explored on the the site, the feature we did, you know, empowerment is such a big part of what makes Metroid what it is. And it's so much more visceral than it is in an RPG, because it's not about numbers. It's like, well, you know, when I had to carefully jump past, well, now I could just screw attack through everything.
Yep.
You know, so that's right. not just not have to worry about the jumping, but actually just demolish the foes and the scenery around. You know, it's so empowering after, you know, what you've been through to get to that point.
And, you know, I think it's fair that we talk about the ending a little bit here, and hopefully this isn't really spoiling for anyone, but I do think that's one of the flaws of Super Metroid, is that the final boss fight is not... I think it's narratively rewarding, but in terms of gameplay, it's not that great, because it's very easy, especially relative to the first two games' final bosses. But the other thing is that basically the way that they deal, instead of designing a final boss or even a final section of the game that is a fair match for Samus's abilities, which are very significant at that point, instead what they do is you get to the final boss and, you know, they pretty much make you helpless. And then the final boss, you know, it just becomes a cutscene where the final boss almost kills you, and then the hatchling comes back and makes you a god, and you absolutely ass rape Mother Brain, and then you get the fuck out of Dodge. And I just think it's a missed opportunity to really put your skills to the test, because at that point you have so many abilities that I think using them well and mixing them together and choosing which weapons to use at which time is an interesting problem that is never really presented by the game. I think
that's the thing, is I always have an ambivalent sort of feeling towards the finale, because in a way it does feel a bit like what we were talking about earlier, the idea of like a cutscene that you don't know it's really a cutscene until you've done it.
Right.
It was the whole sequence was like that. You know, that sort of terror that you were talking about in the NES Metroid is not there. It's much quieter. It's quite sedate. The Metroids are not particularly threatening. I mean, the ambience is nice, kind of, you know, eerie, but apart from that, there's not a whole lot going on. And then the Mother Brain battle itself there's not much to say about that, in terms of the gameplay. As you say, it's a reprise of the NES sort of finale before you get the sort of revival and the monster. But, you know, there's not a whole lot going on there. And I remember, you know, being a little disappointed, obviously, because there's no exploration in Turian either. You know, it's like, obviously, well, this is the last part of the game, you know, so is it going to be a bit like, you know, the wrecked ship or, you know, Meridia or any of these other parts? And it's not, because it's purely linear.
No secrets in Turian.
Absolutely nothing in that area. So, I mean, like, in terms of the final payoff of this sort of interesting brand of storytelling that it had going on, I think it was really good. I think it was great. It's just a shame that they couldn't have woven that in a bit more with some more interesting kind of gameplay applications, because I agree, it's kind of, it's a procession.
Yeah.
And I'm not knocking the ending of the game because I think it is brilliant in the way that it tells the story. Yeah. It's one of the most memorable things in gaming ever. But I think in terms of gameplay, I think there's more they could have done without sacrificing the narrative part.
Yeah, you could have had a more sort of a full and interesting battle that led up to that point. I mean, there's no reason why you couldn't.
Mm-hmm. Well, or you could have just, instead of just turning you into invincible killing machine after the cutscene, they could have made it more of a fair fight.
Well, yeah, but I mean, really, you could still, I mean, you could obviously do whatever you like, but I mean, you still could have had that as the sort of punctuation. But, you know, again, it was kind of like what you didn't know is that you'd have won the fight before that happened. But the fact is that the fight leading up to that was big enough and long enough and hard enough that it didn't really matter that you then had this sort of, you know, quasi cutscene at the end of it where you just demolished, you know, demolished the boss sort of as a sort of exclamation point. I mean, you know what I mean? I don't think they necessarily had to change that part to get it right. They could have just changed
it. No, I wouldn't change anything about the way the hatchling comes in and saves you and all that. I just think there's a gameplay payoff that's missing in that area. I don't know if it should come before that or after that, but it's just not really there. And I just think in terms of gameplay and challenge, the game ends in a whimper. In terms of plot and narration, it ends with a bang. There's no doubt. Mm-hmm. But I just wish it could have gotten both right, you know?
Yeah, and I think it could have done potentially, but it just didn't. I mean, how do you feel about the bosses more generally, some of the other ones, you know? I mean, Ridley was a bit of a... You could kind of brute force him quite a lot, couldn't you, at that point?
Well, you can if you've found a ton of secrets before that, but if not, he can be very difficult.
Yeah, that's a lot of the
games. I think Ridley is a good boss.
Like, a lot of the game, you know, how hard it is dependent upon how far you go out of your way. Again, it's kind of that sandbox thing where it's like how far you go out of your way to power yourself up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can cream most of the bosses in the game if you go around and find every single missile you can, each part you unlock. If you go through there with a fine-tooth comb and find every little thing, you're going to have a lot of missiles going up against every single boss. So.
But it's not like an RPG where it's just a pure investment of time.
True.
It takes actual effort and thinking in order to sort of grind in Metroid, and I think that's why it's more rewarding than an RPG.
Yeah, and some of the more obscure ones are quite complicated puzzles involved to actually.
Oh, yeah,
get
at the end you're like, Holly gets a missile for that?
that's
exactly. Not the point. You got the puzzle for that. Like, the puzzle is the reward. The missile at the end is just kind of the period at the end of the sentence.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I mean, because it's one of these things where I guess they felt comfortable putting in some of the most advanced stuff for things that were kind of peripheral, that weren't central to completing the game.
Exactly.
But yeah, it was just nice to be able to do them. I mean, you know, there's some really intricate stuff in there, and you know, it did have, you know, an item collection rate thing at the end, so it did actually kind of encourage you to say, well, you know, if you finished it and it said you've collected 60% of your items, well then you said, God, you know, there's so much stuff I could look for.
That's part of why the Metroid games are so replayable, is that they're so complex, there's so much shit to do that you're very unlikely to do all of it the first time through, and yet the games are short enough and, you know, especially from Super Metroid on, they're easy enough that it's not that big of a hurdle to go back through them again.
Yeah.
So I think they're very good at encouraging you to play them multiple times.
Well, and I think that one of the main things is that the world is quite tightly designed. I think there's a lot of satisfying interconnections that kind of like the way the game plays out in terms of the kind of the default progression, let's say, as we know, that's kind of, you know, bendable, to say the least. But, you know, you've got kind of a few sort of passages, you know, like there'll be, you know, like the part that you'll spend in, you know, sort of the first time you go to Norfair, when you go to the wrecked ship, the first time you go to Meridia. They're not linear levels, but they're kind of little passages of the game, chapters. But what happens is that the world kind of connects up so that in the end, all these chapters that you kind of experience in a somewhat linear way become totally woven together by the end. You know, you can blow up the glass tube, so all of a sudden, Brinstar and Meridia are completely easily connected in a way that they weren't before. And things like that. So I mean, I think it's definitely one of the, for instance, Metroid Prime, and some of this is just, you know, some of the problems of, you know, it was a very different kind of game, obviously being 3D and everything, felt more partitioned, really.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
I think once you've got every ability and you've seen it all, ZB's in Super Metroid comes together much more satisfyingly. It's really well done how it all hangs together.
Sure, and I think Zero Mission does it even better. And of course, they had another 10 years of experience to draw from when they did that. But, you know, in defense of Metroid Prime, I do think Metroid Prime 2 does a better job of integrating the level design. So there's more interconnectivity. There's, you know, there are more secret passageways and, you know, ways to get around quickly. And then Metroid Prime 3... Well, it doesn't because it's partitioned by design.
It's very explicitly partitioned, isn't it?
Right,
it
really just, right.
It dispenses with the pretense that it's not.
Right, and that's a downfall of granting a wish that many, many, many fans had, including myself, is that, you know, you'd be able to use the ship and fly between different planets and not always be stuck to one area. But because of that, I think we got what we wished for.
Yeah.
In the classic sense, it did end up making it feel a little bit less like a Metroid game.
Yeah, I kind of feel like the whole Metroid Prime series has kind of run its course to a certain
degree. Well, yeah, it was a trilogy.
But I mean that as a concept, though, you know, James Smarthouse comment aside, I feel like it's just that kind of treatment of the Metroid franchise has kind of run its course. And I'd love to see them get back to...
if the next game of Retro Studios is another Metroid game. I really strongly feel that it will be something.
Well, I honestly don't believe they want it to be either.
Probably not. But I guess maybe it would be a good time to get into the kind of the legacy of Super Metroid and some of the games that have been influenced by it. You know, as we said, like the original Metroid, I think it was sort of a cult hit, and over the years, its shadow grew. Of course, in 2001, EGM named it the best game of all time in their top 100 list. And I think they've since published that list again. Well, of course, EGM doesn't even exist now, sadly. But
yeah.
I think they published the top 100 at least one more time, if not two more times, and it moved a couple places down. There are different people involved in making those other lists,
and of course, new games. Yeah.
Well, here's a question for you.
New games coming out.
Here's a question. Do you think that Super Metroid would be as well appreciated as it is right now without Symphony of the Night being made?
No.
That's a great
point. It
definitely
adds to it, because, I mean, I believe in that same chart that Symphony of the Night was in the top 5. So when you consider that Symphony of the Night is held in that regard, and Super Metroid is like its father or one of its parents, it does add to the renown, it adds to the sort of legend, and more people have probably played it as a result, I would have thought.
Yeah.
I think more people have played Symphony of the Night than Super Metroid. And one thing I like about there are a lot of things I like about Symphony of the Night, but one of my favorite things is that it's so nakedly influenced by Super Metroid.
Yeah.
it just wholesale rips off major elements of the game, and it works, and it totally gets away with it because the atmosphere and the character of the game is so totally different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know? This is true. I mean, you know, you go from the sort of the subtle ambience of, you know, to, you know, full orchestral soundtracks, you know, rock, you know, and all it is a kind of that putting that totally different skin on it.
We'll be right back. gothic and magical and, you know, the little RPG elements with leveling up.
Yeah, that's
up,
right. The more so explicitly RPG. What John was talking about, there is a kind of an RPG style thing going on in Super Metroid, but Castlevania
absolutely
made it much more numbers-based, equipment-based, you know, more old-school, you know, more recognizably RPG in character.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, there's the obvious influence of Super Metroid in that it pretty much created its own genre.
Yeah.
And you could say that the original Metroid is the true creator of that genre, but I think by adding the auto map, Super Metroid made it viable. It made it something that you could actually imitate. And also by, you know, by matching up with the current technology, which the NES one could not do. So I think from Super Metroid on, people looked at this game and said, you know, we could do that. You know, that is a viable kind of game. And it, you know, it is really like nothing else. So since that time, it really has become its own genre. And one of the cool things about it is it doesn't really sit as a subset of any other kind of game. It's more of this really, really compelling mixture of other kinds of games that when you mix them all together and cook at 350 degrees, you get this thing that feels quite different from anything else. And so you've got things like Symphony of the Night, but also shit, the Spider-Man Web of Shadows DS game that came out last year is awesome. It is really, really good. And all they had to do there was take Super Metroid and say, you know what? Instead of a walking tank, what if you were Spider-Man and you could move around really fast and shoot your web all over the place? And again, I think it works beautifully in a Spider-Man game because here you have a character whose abilities lend themselves to the kind of non-linear exploration that is very daunting to do in game design because it makes it easy to break sequence. And, you know, they always have tricks to keep you from doing that. But I think it's just a really inspired pairing of character to game design, and Super Metroid makes that possible. You also have things like Cave Story, which I have not played yet, but I'm very excited about the WiiWare release.
Pretty soon, I think it's confirmed for Europe in the next couple of months.
Or you
so can only assume
play it, download it for your PC, and play it for free.
Yeah. Well, they are redoing it quite a bit for WiiWare, so I don't know if it'll make it worth the extra money, but I'm probably going to buy it anyway just because I'm just excited that this kind of game is still being made.
Yeah.
And of course you've got, you know, Metroid Fusion, which is an interesting twist on the formula, but is still very much based on Super Metroid.
Yeah, it's that in some ways it is so Super Metroid and in other ways it is so not. Mm-hmm. In the sense that narrative-wise it's text heavy. From being as minimalist with text as possible.
It's really just taking the introduction of Super Metroid and then just kind of, instead of abandoning that after the introduction, just continue it on at a periodic rate. Because the idea of this background of Samus's face and she's telling you what's going on.
But it's not just that, obviously, but with the computer elements as well, you know, I mean, it's what it's giving you. It's like it's more plot based because it's like individual things are going on in the court. So it's like, so now the SAX has attacked this thing in the space, so you've got to go there and do that, and then this happens. Looking for this weapon upgrade next, or do that, you know, it's very much like it's plotted out.
But now, why do you think, because the series in general has kind of gone in that direction, right? I mean, with Metroid Prime, I mean, there's more of kind of a story element, there, you know, all the kind of stuff you can scan and all that. Do you think that they did that to make it more marketable? Maybe create more of a fully fleshed out world?
Well, it makes it easier for new players to understand, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's true. And also, I mean, there's something to be said for kind of, you know, how much can you pull the same trick twice and, you know, maybe do something a bit different, you know? I mean, mm-hmm. In many ways, you know, if I had to choose which I'd prefer out of Metroid Fusion and Super Metroid, you know, I'd pick Super Metroid. But I was quite accepted, quite happy to have it be different. And it was like, you know, structurally broken up a bit, which probably, again, was somewhat lent itself more to put the portable format.
Yeah.
You know, I think that was some of the reason, some of the factors that went into that decision.
My problem with Metroid Fusion is it's not different enough.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. It's kind of awkward.
Recycles too many powers and level design.
It's a little conservative in a lot of other ways, but you know, I was quite happy to have it be a bit more different. And then Zero Mission is much more back to Super Metroid. But one thing that playing through Super Metroid in 2007 a number of times, I've played through Zero Mission many times, you know, since it came out, is that I do think Zero Mission plays considerably better in terms of its controls.
Yeah.
It plays faster.
Yeah.
The controls are more streamlined. I mean, that thing with in Super Metroid with choosing from the list of icons on the top was just dopey.
Yeah.
Like, you're selected from the missile, super missile, power bomb, grappling.
Yeah, I mean, I think going from Zero Mission back to Super Metroid, it makes Super Metroid feel kind of clunky.
It does.
And it takes me a good 30, 45 minutes before I feel comfortable playing Super Metroid, because, you know, there's certain conveniences that they brought on in Zero Mission that aren't there. And I just have to get used to that fact. And then I'm okay after that. But Zero Mission is just a very I think in terms of pure mechanics, Zero Mission is the best Metroid game. And I think in level design, it's probably the best. But it also has the advantage of being the newest, you know? So
yes.
Yeah, I mean, these games aren't made in a vacuum, so.
Well, that's the thing. What happened with R&D 1... They made, you know, Super Metroid. If you've ever looked at the end credits, the development team is referred to as Dia Force of Team Shikamaru. Is that meant to mean anything to me, really? But Dia Force was basically this purpose-built team from all these different parts of R&D1 and intelligence systems that was kind of bringing back together the people that made Metroid, as we said before. But they didn't really make much of anything after that for a long time that wasn't portable. And of course, Gunpei Yokoi, who was, you know, helped create the series, was the producer on all the titles up to that point, left after, you know, the Virtual Boy disaster.
I wonder if Super Metroid was a contributor to that as well.
If they did lose money on it, I mean,
it was a liability at the time.
It doesn't matter how good it is. At that time especially, they're probably looking at it and saying, well, you know, you backed this and, you know, it was a dud. So, you know.
He was never forced out, because that's very un-Japanese. Instead, he was
right.
He was put in a position. He was put in a position where he was basically left to do nothing.
Right. That's very Japanese.
I mean, along the series timeline, where did Metroid Prime fit in? Was it released before like Zero Mission and Fusion?
It came out a day and date with Fusion.
Day and date with Fusion.
Yeah, the end of 2002 that they came out together.
Because they had that feature where if you beat one, you could unlock stuff in the other.
That's right. GBA connectivity. Yeah. So, I mean, it did take... that's the thing. It took an awful long time for Metroid to return from Super Metroid, which, again, kind of, you know... It lends credence to what Johnny was saying about, you know, how Nintendo kind of perceived its successfulness.
I'm not even sure it's that, but I think they were pretty clever in realizing that, you know, maybe with the N64, if they had tried to make a Metroid game for 64, it might have turned out like the NES one, where, you know, they tried to do too much.
It wasn't sort of fit for purpose.
And it just couldn't handle. I mean, you see that in Perfect Dark, where the system really can't handle what the game is throwing at it.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think there's definitely a practicality aspect to it as well.
It was frustrating as hell for fans like me.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, obviously they didn't ever get like a successor to Metroid 2 on the Game Boy. You know, I mean, the R&D were very busy producing sequels to Wario. You know, they got to Super Mario Land 3, Wario Land, and then Wario Land 2 and Wario Land 3. I mean, they were creating these.
That's another great successor to Super Metroid. The Wario Land games, especially 2 and 3, are very much influenced by Super Metroid.
So that's what they were doing, but then it was when, obviously, when the GBA came along, I guess they felt they had the canvas to do a real follow-up to Metroid Fusion. And it was R&D 1 again, it was Sakamoto again, it was a lot of the same people that were involved with Super Metroid. So, I mean, you really...
And they made Zero Mission the following year as well.
And, yeah, that was quite a quick turnaround, really, wasn't it? You know,
Zero Mission was a shocking announcement that they would... It's unlike Nintendo to go back and dramatically remake one of their old games. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly they do ports and re-releases all the time, and Metroid was one of the NES classic series for GBA, but just a little shocking to see Nintendo go back and say, you know what, this game we made back in the 80s had some serious problems, and we're going to redo it.
I disagree.
It's shocking. It's just...
Because it wasn't the first remake that they didn't put out on the GBA.
Well, they did lots of ports, but I honestly think it's almost inappropriate to refer to it as a remake.
Well,
I mean, we're getting into semantics here, and I know it's annoying, but the point is, Zero Mission is as much a remake as Super Castlevania IV is a remake. And no one would call that a remake.
I mean, James, are you referring to things like Mario Advance?
No, actually, I'm referring to things like Fire Red and Leaf Green. Which are cross that line between remake and port also, because there is so much new content in there that wasn't in the original games.
I guess so.
But you know what I mean? I mean, the point is, like, you know, Super Castlevania 4 and Metroid Zero Mission, they both say they share the plot, which was pretty much irrelevant to the game anyway.
It was pretty much irrelevant right up until, I would say, Prime.
Yeah, so they share the plot of the originals, but the gameplay is completely different. The art's completely different. You know what I mean?
Well, that's the funny thing, is I think Super Metroid is almost as much of a remake of the first one as Zero Mission is in a lot of ways. It takes the same environments, but now you go through
them
in a completely
almost like
different
alternate
way.
Remakes alternate revisitings of the.
Well, that's
that's
the bizarre thing about Zero Mission, is like playing through it. I mean, that was the first time, including Fusion. Zero Mission was the first time where I played through a Metroid game where I was pretty much in ecstasy the entire time. You know, I felt like I was appreciating it in full capacity the first time I played it through. And I think it's just that all the experiences had, you know, accumulated in my mind. And at this point, just the way that it surprised me was great. But also thinking through it, I think, why remake the first Metroid? You kind of already did, right? With Super Metroid. And yet, they throw these things in there. They're completely unexpected. And I think Zero Mission is... Now, we're not really talking about it today, but I do think Zero Mission is incredible, and I still play it today.
It takes so much of the good things of Super Metroid, and it does a few. I think like the art style is very much its own. It's so much more cartoony, mm-hmm. comic book kind of look, and it's more suited to the low res environment of the GBA.
Well, I think it also better represents what Samus looked like in the first Metroid game, which is kind of this weird. It's not quite as, what's the word for it, lithe and physical looking as it was in Super Metroid. It was a little bit more blocky.
Yeah.
So yeah, well, because it was very chunky, the style,
right,
it did
come out being almost cartoonish because of that. So I think it was a good decision on their part.
Yeah, but she didn't look like an upright gorilla like she did in Fusion.
And also, like, the sort of abstract backgrounds that were mostly black, which, of course, in the NES, they were completely black.
Right.
But you had these sort of little comic book flourishes, like kind of monochrome thing going on. But, you know, so I think it was stylistically a real sort of nice differentiation from Super Metroid, which has much more... It's all about detail. We talked about it before, you know, the little glowing, all this stuff. It's the subtleties that are really nice about the visual style of Super Metroid, whereas I think art-wise, Zero Mission might be more appealing to me. I mean, like, look at Kraid in both games. Kraid looks a shitload better in Zero Mission. I don't know. It's something really kind of like he's too side on in Super Metroid. He's so in profile. It's kind of weird.
He looks like he's 2D, really. Yep. He looks like he's a cardboard cutout of a boss.
Yep.
Yeah. if we can talk about Kraid for a second, I mean, you say that, but when I first played Super Metroid, having, you know, been pretty familiar with the original Metroid, I loved Kraid. I thought it was so
still amazing,
bold,
like
so crazy, because, you know, you fight the fake Kraid before you get to the real thing in
yeah,
Super
that's
Metroid.
Right, yeah.
And the fake one is the size. I mean, that was what was silly about the bosses in the original Metroid, is they were the same size as Samus. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're just little characters hopping around and shooting crap at you. In Super Metroid, they really said, you know what, bigger is better. Let's make these bosses scary. Let's make them intimidating.
In the original Metroid, they're Mega Man bosses. I mean, if you think about mm-hmm. it. They basically are.
Scale-wise, yeah.
Well, not just scale-wise, in the combat. They're little enemies that hop around and shoot at you, and they have patterns you have to memorize.
Very predictable patterns.
That you have
yeah,
to avoid.
They're not that much different than normal enemies, except they take a lot more hits to kill. In Super Metroid, they are events, you know?
Oh, yeah.
They're a little more puzzle-based in Super Metroid.
Yeah, well, certainly, I mean, like, what's his name, Dragoon or whatever, you know, the one with the grapple beam trick, which again, is kind of another one of these kind of nice Easter egg things, like, you know, there's no, like, you know, if that was in Metroid Prime, it's like, oh, look, I can lock onto that. Why can I lock onto that? Let's try that. Oh, yeah, there you go. Whereas, you know, there's nothing that explicit about it. It's kind of just a fluke if you did it, really.
Beating him?
No, using the grapple beam trick where you end up electrocuting him to death.
Oh, you mean in the... I was thinking of the guy that you have to knock off the bridge.
Oh, Crocomire.
That's a really interesting boss, in that you can't... He's invincible, yeah. He's invincible, and the only way to kill him is to knock him off the bridge, but the game obviously doesn't tell you that. You just have to pay attention. You have to realize he doesn't blink when you shoot him. He just backs up. Mm-hmm. And eventually, you know, you have to figure out,
bones,
oh, maybe I should keep backing him up. Well, the bones, you don't really fight. That's more of a cutscene thing, but it's
yeah.
awesome.
Again, yeah, there's a lot of that, isn't there? I mean, there really is when you look back at it. But his bones kind of come out of the lava and scare you as well. You get with a little cheap, spring-loaded cat bit.
Yeah, I think you can look at the Metroid series as being, you know, one of the original survival horror games. And I don't want to belittle it by saying that, but I think in some ways it captures the essence of what that term should evoke better than things like Resident Evil do. It is about you are all alone. There's something very scary about being all alone. There's nothing really friendly about these games.
In space, no one
and
can hear you scream,
Johnny. And even in Mario, you have that. Yeah, well, you're not really in space.
That sense of isolation, I think, is somewhat preserved in the first two Metroid Primes, especially the first one, even though you've got a lot of reading to do. And obviously it is not in Fusion, because you are pretty much constantly in contact with your computer friend.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Super Metroid was really the quintessential game for that, because, you know, there's no talking because there's no one to talk to. Yeah, why would you? You know, and there's no kind of hints because nothing would give you a hint. It's pure, you know, it's as much just you in this world as possible.
Said that the Metroid series is really about, you know, archaeology. It's about digging out these ancient civilizations and discovering all the horrors that were left behind and dealing with them and trying to survive it, you know, and eventually you get out of there in a pretty dramatic fashion. But it's about, you know, getting into some pretty scary shit where you're clearly not really supposed to go. And going in there and taking care of business and making it out alive. So in that sense, I think it's fair to look at these as a sort of proto survival horror. Obviously, they take a very, very different approach to it than things like Silent Hill and Resident Evil do. But I think it's fair to say that they are about those things. They're about survival and, to some sense, horror. And again, that's what makes it so different than anything else Nintendo does, is that the game is kind of unsettling and creepy.
Yeah, but see, I'm not going to follow you on that one, because unsettling and creepy really isn't horror to me.
I think it's the best kind of horror.
Yeah, the more psychological.
It's a personal taste, but
yeah, this early on in some of the games, it's just got this perverse thing where it's more difficult early. And that does kind of apply to Super Metroid.
Mega Man, always hardest at the beginning.
There's more of a kind of resource management thing going on as well, isn't there? In terms of, mm-hmm. you don't feel at liberty to spray missiles around because you haven't got very many. And so, you need to be careful. And that's kind of more deliberate part of the game.
But then after you have thousands, or
eventually, like we said,
it becomes almost irrelevant.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But that, I think that's good, because otherwise, retraversing the game would just be such a chore. It would be ridiculous. I mean, you have to have that empowerment process. Okay? I mean, that is what a Metroid is all about for me. It gives you a feeling of accomplishment, because it's like, well, I had to try this hard to do this before, and now I can do it on a whim.
It's a kind of character development.
Mm.
And I feel like that was the true success of Metroid Prime. People were worried that it would feel like a generic first-person shooter. And what they really captured in Metroid Prime is the feeling of character development, is that as you play through the game, Samus gains these abilities that profoundly change the way you play the game. And by the end of the game, you feel like you're almost playing it a different way than you were at the beginning. And not very many first-person shooters do that. You're shooting dudes at the beginning, and you're shooting dudes at the end, and you might have a bigger gun, but you're doing the same thing, you just point and shoot. And in Metroid Prime, they capture this feeling that, you are more powerful, you can go different places, you can do different things, you can do things in an easier way. And that directly comes from Super Metroid.
Yeah.
It's just amazing that they translated it into this more, this 3D environment.
I think that is the sort of the unlikely success of Metroid Prime, that people wouldn't have thought that it could capture so much of Super Metroid in it,
mm-hmm.
considering it's so fundamentally different. And that's why I think it was so wonderfully received. And obviously, that game was incredibly well received at the time, and I think that was kind of piggybacking onto that groundswell of sort of appreciation for Metroid, for Super Metroid, that had built up, in an 8-year wilderness without it.
It almost seems intentional that Nintendo allowed the legend of Super Metroid to blossom, into this deep yearning for more. We need a new Metroid. And when they finally delivered it, it was in many ways so reminiscent of Super Metroid. I mean, I've heard the argument that Metroid Prime is almost its own remake of Super Metroid, just in 3D. And I think that's a bit cynical, but it does draw from it very, very, very heavily.
No, I mean, you've got the there's environmental similarities. Obviously a lot of the powers are drawn from it, and it has references in terms of the music and some of the boss characters.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's and of course the opening to the game, going to the frigate, and then going to it's so
yeah.
if, like straight from going to the space colony and then going
sure.
to ZB's.
But I think to say that is unfair to Retro, and I think it discards a lot of the very creative original elements that they put into Metroid Prime. So I prefer to avoid that.
Yeah,
that kind
I think
of
that's
comment.
That's stretching it, but there's no doubt that was in one sense, the template for the game, and I think they've said as much, mm-hmm. you know, because, you know, why wouldn't it be? I mean, that's sure. the point.
And just like Echoes, the template for Echoes is Link to the Past, and that's pretty blatant yeah. once you start playing the
yeah.
game.
Yeah.
You know? And that's fine. I think that's a game that's probably not, not referenced enough. So it didn't bother me. I really like Echoes. But anyway, I think our chat about Super Metroid is kind of come to an end here. So James and John, I know Greg and I dominated this discussion a bit. So if you guys have any closing comments, make them now.
Well, I mean, where do you think, I mean, in terms of the future of the series, I mean, I would really like to see them go back and do, I mean, for the Wii, I would love to see them go back and do a full-fledged 2D version of it. I mean,
yeah, I mean, obviously that is something you'd like to see. I mean, people sometimes sort of snicker at this sort of idea that, you know, people only want these 2D games on consoles to be sort of hardcore or whatever, but there's a lot you can do with, you know, the art and all that on consoles you just can't do on the low-res environment.
There is, but I'm not sure that it's got the kind of appeal that they would be willing to sink the development.
Whether they'd be willing to do it is a completely yeah. other matter. And, I mean, the disturbing fact is that, you know, they've had the DS, it's a runaway success, it's getting on for 5 years old, and they have not made a traditional Metroid game.
But they've not
yet.
Really made any games for the DS in a while, with the exception of, like, Pokemon Platinum. I mean,
that's very
it's
true.
It's so hands-off.
But the point being that with R&D 1, you know, they actually were rolled, sort of incorporated into the wider EAD in about 2005, which was the last time we heard anything about Metroid Dread. Back then, so you kind of wonder whether there any autonomy that they had to kind of pursue Metroid projects as if it's been taken away from them, because I mean they would have been from inside EAD, they would have been creating things like WarioWare, which is their creation, like probably Rhythm Heaven for the GBA and the DS and all that. So I mean they're still creating things, but they may now not have the same latitude to make the things they want to make that they used to.
Yeah,
so the odds of a 2D Metroid, be it on console, be it digital distribution, be it DS or successor to DS, I don't know how good they are. I really don't. I mean, it's been 5 years since Zero Mission. That's quite a long time.
Yeah, I mean, Metroid, I think the series still kind of remains, especially with, you know, with Nintendo's kind of focus, you know, on the, you know, non-gamer kind of segment, you know, trying to kind of expand in that direction. Once again, it's kind of with Metroid, nobody really knows what they're going to do with it, because it's still very much a black sheep in there. You know, it's very easy to say, okay, well, of course, you know, they'll make another Mario game. It's easy. But Metroid, it's always kind of had its cult following, and I don't know.
Here's something to chew on with respect to making a 2D game on the DS. They'll make another Mario game, but even though New Super Mario Brothers was an absolute phenomenal success for them, they've not made another one, despite the fact that
it's almost too much of a success for them to make another one.
That's
the point. It's like what we talked about with Spirit Tracks. The reason why we're getting Spirit Tracks instead of New Super Mario Brothers 2 is because Zelda has sold as much as it's going to sell.
Yeah, I
mean,
New
Super Mario Brothers,
but whereas it would probably be a lot easier to make another New Super Mario Brothers game than it would be to make Spirit Tracks.
I agree, yeah. But anyway, I think the prospects of a 2D Metroid are not closed for two reasons. First, we should probably, I mean, we've already talked about it on the show, but we should come to expect that there will be a very long gap between 2D Metroid games. Mm-hmm. That has been the historical pattern, and I don't think that the most recent ones were such runaway successes that they had to run out and speed up the schedule and say, we need to put this on an every other year timetable, guys. But we had 8 years between Super Metroid and Metroid Fusion, and we still got Fusion. So 2010 would be 8 years since Fusion. So I think, you know, after next year, if we still don't get a new 2D Metroid, then I'll start to worry, because then it's kind of really, that's a long gap for Metroid. But the other thing is, the game design itself is still popular.
You
still have Metroidvania. You still have the Wario Land series.
Yeah.
You still have Spyro and Spider-Man using this kind of game design. And you have Cave Story come out on WiiWare. If anything, it's more popular now than it ever has been.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Nintendo has to look at that and say, you know, people still like this kind of game. It's not stupid for us to make another one at some point.
No, sure. I mean, it will be a challenge as well, because, I mean, they've flogged ZBs and all that to death. They've done that.
Yeah.
They've done it fully, you know, for three games or whatever. You know, so obviously Fusion was a bit structurally weird, and obviously it had this very artificial environment, again, which is quite different. But they might have to look at the conditions may well have to be right for something that would have to be probably a more significantly creative endeavor. Or, on the complete opposite side of the scale, they could just remake Super Metroid.
Or Metroid 2.
I think you're looking at a blatant remake as your next game that's coming out.
That would be okay with me.
Yeah,
you could either do Metroid 2. You could look at as doing the Zero Mission treatment, in the sense that it's the same concept. You go to the Metroid home world to wipe them out, but make a completely different game that plays very different, and all that sort of stuff. So there's that. I guess there wouldn't be that much point in remaking Super Metroid other than to sort of imbue it with Zero Mission smoothness.
Well, first off, if we do get another 2D Metroid game, I don't think it'll be on the DS. I think Nintendo's last big hurrah on the DS is probably going to be Spirit Tracks. I feel like they'll be content.
You may be right about that.
To let that one run with the third parties, because they've basically been letting the third parties run the DS as it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And then I think
been doing a damn good job of it, judging from my library this year.
And then I think they'll focus their efforts on whatever their next handheld is. And I don't think that's far coming. I think I think we're maybe 2 years out from that.
I think fall of 2010. Well, we really don't know, Metroid's not done. It may very well be a few more years before we get a new one, but I think Nintendo has seen, especially that they greenlit three Metroid Prime games, I think they've seen that there is an enduring, maybe a fixed audience for this series, but there is an enduring audience for it who will continue to buy the games. So,
well, the one thing that does bode well for the future is that they did bring Metroid Prime back with the new Play Control series. Which means that they recognize, they recognize that there's an audience out there for it.
Sure, but I don't know whether we're expecting, some sort of major renaissance in Chibi Robo's, fortunes or,
Touché, Greg. You guys are some cynical bastards. Cynical bastards.
And you're idyllic, and I appreciate that, John. So we need to wrap up this discussion. I think it's been a really good one, and I hope everybody's enjoyed listening to it. I'm kind of all psyched up now about Metroid, and I kind of want to go finish playing through Super Metroid the seventh or eighth time on Virtual Console. So, all right, we're going to close it off there. Thanks for listening, and we will be back next week with a more regular episode featuring all of your highly anticipated regular weekly features. So, keep your emails coming. If you have any comments about this episode or anything else in the world of Nintendo, you can send those to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And if you're listening for the first time, I hope you'll subscribe to the show, jump into iTunes, and give us a review. We'd really appreciate that. So some of you may know that along with being the 15th anniversary of Super Metroid, it's also the 20th anniversary of Nintendo's Game Boy handheld release, the granddaddy of all successful portable game systems. We're not going to have time to cover that really with the respect it deserves on Radio Free Nintendo, since we did this Super Metroid episode. But TYP, who is a very big fan of Game Boy and knows a hell of a lot more about it than I do, is doing a special episode. I believe is actually the 50th episode of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition. And James, were you on that?
I was, yes.
All right. I haven't heard it yet. It's not public yet, but I'm really looking forward to it. That's a great podcast, and I hope you'll look for that too. So with that being said, it's time for us to go, and we'll see you next week. Bye.
Later.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Metroid is copyright Nintendo 1986. Super Metroid is copyright Nintendo 1994. Castlevania Symphony of the Night is copyright Konami 1997. Metroid Prime and Metroid Fusion are copyright Nintendo 2002. Metroid Zero Mission is copyright Nintendo 2004.